I am Planta on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. In 1995, at the age of 13, Craig Kilberger founded Free the Children, an international development and youth empowerment organization. It is the world's largest network of kids helping kids. Since then, it has built over 500 schools around the world and has provided education to well over 50,000 children. He is also the founder of Me to We, which encourages ethical living and social responsibility. He's a best-selling author and joins me now to discuss his latest book, The World Needs Your Kid, How to Raise Children Who Care and Contribute. It is published by MeToWe and Greystone and is co-written by Craig and his brother Mark with the journalist Shelley Page. It features contributions from Desmond Tutu, Mia Farrow, Jane Fonda, Steve Nash, and Dr. Jane Goodall. It's well-illustrated, accessible, and useful with tips for children and parents about how we can all make a difference. There's also an event in Vancouver on the 29th, Me to We Day, which we'll talk about as well. MeToWe.com and FreeTheChildren.com are two websites you should check out. I've long admired Craig for his good work and tenacity. I am pleased to welcome to the Planta Online program Craig Kilberger. Good morning, Mr. Kilberger.
Good morning. Thank you for the kind welcome.
Thanks for joining us. So this all began when you were 12, and we're the same age. So I can't remember when exactly I first heard about you, probably after you founded Free the Children. You were reading the paper, were you?
I was reading the comic section. In fact, I was reaching for the comics in my local newspaper, the Toronto Star, and I saw on the front page the story of a young boy in Pakistan named Iqbal Masih. And he was a child slave. He was bought and sold at a young age. He escaped when he was 10. He spoke out against his conditions. And he was killed at the age of 12. And so I looked at my life growing up here in Canada, and I looked at his life halfway around the world. And it made me so angry that I ripped this article from the newspaper. I brought it to my grade 7 class. I said, I don't know what, but I need your help. And that's how Free the Children was born.
So you weren't looking for a cause or to change the world, were you?
No, absolutely not. Came from a very typical, ordinary, middle-class Canadian upbringing. Parents as school teachers, an older brother, you know, grew up with a dog. Like a very ordinary childhood. But you can't escape what's going on in this world, and I think so many young people see these images, whether they be Iraq and Afghanistan or environmental degradation or poverty or child labor or child soldiers, and are looking to help. And in our case, you know, going back to 1995, at that point there weren't a lot of ways for elementary school kids and middle school kids to really make a difference. This was, you know, before the internet was very popularized. This was before the technological revolution has linked all these NGOs that have emerged so much. So we were searching for a cause and searching for a way to get involved, and that's how Free the Children went from a small group of kids to growing into a movement when other young people heard about what we were doing and wanted to get engaged.
Now, your parents, how soon was it? You know, you mentioned they were teachers, and you talk about this in the book, about what they've meant to your life and how supportive they were to you and Mark. Did they realize early on that the world needed their kids?
My parents are amazingly supportive, but and one of the reasons why we wrote this book is because a lot of people ask, you know, Free the Children today is built, as you mentioned, 500 schools, and we have a million youth members now in the States involved in our programming every year, and, you know, 2,000 schools in Canada where we work, we're getting young people engaged in volunteerism and service. But growing up was simple things our family did, nothing that ever we would have imagined would lead us to where we are, but simple things. From every morning, our dad would lower the newspaper on the kitchen table instead of, you know, reading it upright like many parents. He'd lay it on the kitchen table. We'd read it as a family, talk about stories, articles, what was happening in the world. So when I saw this article about Iqbal Masih, this child slave, for me, it wasn't just a one-time thing. We had started these type of conversations as a family. Or, you know, our mom, when we'd go to downtown Toronto, since we grew up in the suburbs, going downtown was a big deal. And seeing people who were panhandling or asking for spare change on the side of the road, she would walk up to them and open her purse, and as she was looking for some coins, she would speak to them and ask their name, where they're from. And it was years later that she told us the reason why she did that was so that Mark and I, my brother and I, wouldn't just walk by, but we would look them in the eyes and hear that they have a name and acknowledge their humanity. And a lot of the reason why we wrote the book was to tell these type of simple stories from our childhood, but from the childhood of many others, that relate how their parents or teachers or mentors did small things but had a profoundly impactful role in the future view of how us and other young people looked at the world.
I read the book on the weekend, and this is not a memoir, so people listening to us might think it's a memoir. It's not. It's actually, it's full of anecdotes. It's full of a lot of lists that people enjoy reading that I'm sure people will enjoy reading. But I was thinking, you mentioned that your mom talking to the homeless guy when you guys were kids. You went into Toronto. I was also thinking about the story about your mom and the Chans.
Yes, absolutely. So
I'm wondering, they obviously remain supportive today. How are your parents? Well, I mean, they're obviously not buying you pizzas anymore and things like that, right?
Well, never underestimate pizza, though, when you're first starting an organization. Amazingly supportive, especially in the earliest of days. You know, they never would have imagined that this organization grew as large as it was, and it is today. You know, I remember as a kid trying to convince my parents, and especially my mom, to let me take time off school to go backpacking through India and Pakistan and Bangladesh and Thailand and Nepal researching child labor. And both parents would have laughed at the idea. And you know, of course, our parents said no. It took them 6 months to convince them. But our mom said you had to raise half the money and prove that you'd be safe. And I was 12 years old at this time. So I found a chaperone, and I raised the money shoveling driveways. And along with the chaperone, this 25-year-old, eventually my parents, because they knew this was something so important to me, and they believed in this idea, and they very much believed in something we write about in the book called coming-of-age rituals. They very much believe, as parents, that we live in a society where so often young people aren't sufficiently challenged and aren't sufficiently given the opportunity to see that they have a role and a responsibility to play. So they let me go on that journey. So whether that be the earliest faith, and that was an extraordinary act of parenting, or even in the current day where they're retired teachers now and they teach at our schools overseas. It's how they can support the organization and support the mission. They've always been extraordinarily supportive, extraordinarily nurturing, and really the greatest role models that my brother and I could ever have.
And they weren't disappointed that you didn't go to Upper Canada College?
You know, it's funny. Parents are parents. I recently finished an executive MBA, and I'm 26 and like yourself, still quite young. And my mom turned to me at that point, and bear in mind, she had a childhood dream that to be a doctor, and that's what I thought I'd be when I was younger. And she turned to me and said, you know, there's still time for you to go to med school. And I looked at her and I said, Mom, we've got, you know, field offices in 5 countries, projects in 45 countries. We have about 1 million people who receive the medical programs that we provide in addition to the schools and clean water and alternative income projects. You know, I didn't become a doctor, but we're still making that dream come true in other ways. And so parents will always be parents, but they are the most supportive and loving, not because they did big things, but because of the small things. And when we wrote The World Needs Your Kid and interviewed other, you know, well-known activists, from Nobel Peace Prize laureates to, you know, famous celebrities and even iconic Canadians like Sarah Polley, who's known not only as an actress and director, but also for her work against poverty, or people like Steve Nash, who's, again, not only known for on the court but off the court, his work helping Africa, or, you know, the well-known celebrities of our parents' generation, especially the Jane Fondas and the Mia Farrows. It's interesting when you hear in their lives what really inspired them, you realize it wasn't big things. It was small, simple things that families did, whether it be a map of the world on their child's bedroom wall or a jar of loose change for collecting for a cause or cleaning out their closets in the holiday season to give to local charities extra clothes and supplies or going on a family volunteer trip instead of laying on a beach in a warm country. These simple things, something that, you know, any family can do, really had such a profound impact in the way how their kids grew up and looked at the world.
Why do you think it is that we lose track of these simple things? That, I mean, the stigma on young people, people our age, people younger than us, people that are 12 even,
yeah.
When we were 12 and people that are 12 now, is it that they're lazy, unmotivated, distracted by other things?
Indeed. And you know, sadly, you're right. And you look at the mass media and with traditional media, you know, especially in our culture where it's a culture of negative media. If it bleeds, it leads. That the stories that we read about young people are of gang violence or of, you know, dropping out in school or you know, the negative stories, but we don't hear the positive ones nearly enough. We have the honor in our organization to do these events you mentioned called We Days, for example. So on September 29th, we're coming to your hometown, coming to Vancouver.
Right.
And then a week later, we're back, you know, in Toronto here. In each of those cities, in Vancouver, we have 16,000 students from almost 1,000 schools coming together at GM Place. In Toronto, a week later, another 16,000 from 1,200 schools coming together at Air Canada Centre, and they're hearing speakers like the Dalai Lama or, you know, Elie Wiesel, who wrote Nights, the Nobel laureate fighting against genocide and the world raising awareness about the Holocaust, or Betty Williams, another Nobel laureate, or Dr. Jane Goodall, the environmentalist, or Robert Kennedy Jr., the environmentalist, or, you know, extraordinary people like Jeff Skoll, who made the film An Inconvenient Truth. You know, this list goes on and on, from sports heroes to singers like Sarah McLachlan or the Canadian Tenors or Headley or Jason Mraz. You know, in bringing together this day-long event, it's televised, it's a national broadcast, it's a celebration of what young people can accomplish. In addition to 34,000 students in the stadiums, 5,000 schools are watching the web broadcast, and an estimated 3 million Canadians will be tuning in to the CTV primetime special. It's something that carries this message nationally to give a different view of young people and to show that youth truly want to make a difference and are searching. Because it's, for us, it's much more than just an event. It kicks off all of our campaigns that we run in the schools, including this year we're launching a challenge called 10 by 10 in the year 2010 for each student to fundraise in their schools $10 for each student in their school. Now, it may not seem like a lot, but just like that Obama effect, when that $10 with all the youth who we work with is added up, that's enough to adopt 10 villages and to provide clean water and medical and alternative income to 100,000 people in developing countries. And we're asking them to give 10 hours of volunteer service, and that adds up to more than 1 million hours of volunteer service by young Canadians helping out on causes from food banks to homeless shelters to drop-in centers to the environment locally. Really, it is a phenomenal movement that I don't think many adults recognize exists in this country, and we should be proud of sons and daughters, nieces and nephews who volunteer, who reach out globally, who make an extraordinary contribution locally.
So what can adults do, aside from reading the book, to help raise this the consciousness of, of children, young people today?
Absolutely. Well, it's first, I think, it's a mindset shift. You know, in writing the book, with the actual inspiration, the reason why we sat down to pen the paper was because of a conversation that we were having with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And he brought a group of people, 30 of us, or my brother and I included, we were the token young people, together at a conference to ask what is the greatest challenge facing our time. And everyone talked about weapons of mass destruction, terrorism, and global warming. And the Dalai Lama kept saying, well, our society knows how to solve these problems. We know how to feed people. We know how to address climate change if we really wanted to. But what's holding us back? And finally, he summed up, he said, the greatest challenge of our time is that we're raising a generation of passive bystanders. And those words really stuck with me, because he went on to explain that so often parents and teachers, in his view, and I share this belief, try to protect kids from what's happening in the world. So they tell them to close their eyes, or they change the news, or they try to protect them from all the negativity in the world, and they tell them that, you know, they'll be great leaders of tomorrow, and someday when they grow up, they'll change the world. But we need to see a mindset shift where parents and teachers and adults recognize every kid knows about Iraq and Afghanistan. They've experienced bullying in the schoolyard. They know that there's this negativity. So we need to give them age-appropriate ways to respond. So starting with that realization, how do you take that journey? Well, you know, the book has tons of tips, but even, again, just sharing a few, most importantly, be a positive role mentor. Be someone in the young people's life who they turn to, who they know that you volunteer and that you're passionate about causes and you give part of your funds as a donation, that you shop ethically, that you share these stories of heroes to young people in their life. To create opportunities for the young people to realize a very simple equation that we believe is issue plus gift equals better world. Help every young person recognize they have an issue, something they care about, whatever it is for that young person. They have a gift to share. And you don't have to be wealthy or prime minister to change the world. Maybe if your gift is music, you play the guitar at a local retirement home. Or maybe it's sports. You do an event at your school to raise cans of food that you collect as the entry fee for a good cause. Or maybe it's building things with your hands and you volunteer at a build site. Or maybe it's being a compassionate listener and helping your friends and other siblings. How do you make that young person feel important? Because issue plus gift equals better world. It's really starting a journey as a family and consciously carving out enough time. And just as important as getting straight A's in math and science, or just as important as being captain of the sports team, that our society recognizes we need to raise kids who learn to care and contribute, because we don't consciously set aside the time and create those opportunities in our society.
You're obviously not a passive bystander, and for you it's been 14, nearly 15 years now of doing this. You're still motivated now, right? You seem to never tire every time I see you on TV or hear of you.
You know, we all face struggles on a daily basis, but I'm quite fortunate in the sense that I get a chance to see a lot of the change happening with our projects. You know, last week I got back from 2 months. I was in East Africa at the sites where we helped build schools, and we brought about 2,000 young Canadians on volunteer trips this summer. Like, it's seeing them dig, lay bricks, walls rise, schools be opened, medical clinics happen. You know, it's an amazing sight when, you know, we live in a society so often of scarcity and so often of negative messages, especially today where, you know, stories on the economy or stories of fear in our post-9/11 world, that to stand in a rural community in the middle of Africa and to see a group of Canadian kids, and kids from around the world for that matter, who join us, see a school rise and see local kids so excited that they literally run to the doors of that school. And in one of the communities, when they were opening the doors, they stopped, the local kids in Kenya stopped, because they were arguing over who gets the honor to open the doors for their school for the first time.
Yeah.
Like, you see that, and you know, I think I'm the luckiest person in the world with what we do with Free the Children, and having a chance to see a whole new generation of young people who are passionate, and overseas to see what that translates into, lives being changed.
But you still find time to do the things that you enjoy doing, and you know, the stuff that other people our age do, right?
Absolutely, but it's an interesting question of, you know, other people our age and what we do, and you know, it's since I was 12 and started Free the Children, I used to hear questions of a typical childhood. You know, it's interesting when you look overseas, it differs our definition of what's typical. And one of the reasons why we wrote The World Needs Your Kid was to challenge this notion of so often young people, and not in our age, but especially the younger ages, especially when I was a teenager, which again wasn't that long ago, so often people define teenagers, and how teenagers define themselves is, you know, the peer group they belong to, or the music they listen to, or the brand names that they wear, or the malls where they hang out, or, you know, it's instead of the contribution they make to society, instead of who they are. And so I really think that a lot of young people are searching for more. You know, I love a movie just like anyone else. I love hanging out with friends. But I think fundamentally a lot of people, whether that be 9-to-5 job or in their schooling, fundamentally feel there's got to be more and are looking to make a tangible difference in this world, looking to leave a legacy, looking to have a reason to get up in the morning and to make this world a slightly better place. And whether you be, you know, a teenager feeling that desire or a retired grandparent feeling that desire, in fact, the fastest growing volunteer trips, we lead our grandparents and grandkids together now. It's Free the Children helps to answer that question with very simple, easy-to-do actions in a family, in a community, that you can take to create a better world. And that's why I think the organization grows, and that's why I think people respond to the message.
No, you've seen the world from a unique vantage point these past 14 years or so. Do you think the world is a better place today than it was then?
It's interesting when you look at statistics, and it's a personal passion close to my heart is the issue of child labor, for example, and the welfare of children. And if you look globally, certain indicators are more positive, and certain indicators are certainly more negative. And if you look at issues, for example, like child labor, you see a general decrease, fewer children today than, for example, when we first started Free the Children, there were 250 million child laborers, today an estimated 211 million, so more kids who are going to school. You see infant mortality rates have largely decreased. Children are living longer, healthier lives. Maternal mortality has decreased. But the numbers are very skewed, and they don't necessarily reflect the true picture, because those strides are mostly taking place in parts of Latin America or Asia. In the past 20 years, there's been an extraordinary decrease in a lot of indicators regarding child challenges, from infant mortality to issues around malaria, tuberculosis. You find more children today in school, especially more young girls in school, but the numbers don't reflect the one geographical region that's really the holdout, and that's Africa. Where sub-Saharan Africa, still 1 in 5 kids don't reach their 5th birthday. Where you look at Sierra Leone, where we do a lot of work, and the maternal mortality rate is 1 in 8. So when you look at the needs of this world and really the forgotten corners of this world, you're looking at Africa. And so those numbers as a whole sometimes don't tell the truth of the world community has largely ignored its commitments to that continent. And a lot of people say, well, we give aid, but when you really delve into the truth in those numbers, a lot of it's tied aid. A lot of the aid that we give is debt repayments, so we're forgiving debts as opposed to really giving aid for projects. A lot of it is food that we'll send or emergency bailouts. We don't invest in long-term development. We don't invest in what it really takes for a community to lift itself out of poverty in the long, sustainable term. So are things getting better? You know, there's so many questions, and obviously, you know, there are many different ways to look at that. But when it comes to my particular passion for child welfare, yes, we are winning this battle. But sadly, there are certain parts of the world, particularly in Africa, where there is so much work still to do.
And you're hopeful about the young people here in this country?
Massively. Well, again, you know, to stand, you know, We Day, the event that we host, is the largest secular gathering of its type that brings together young people celebrating a positive message of service in North America now, for that matter. So you standing in a stadium with, you know, 16,000 students representing their 1,000 schools, seeing the knowledge of 5,000 more schools watching this broadcast, millions more watching on television, launching this message of service. I'm not sure sometimes if we, even in the organization, can appreciate the long-term impact this has on these young people who are graduating from these organizations using our curriculum or in the camps or conferences or working with many organizations out there. And when they become adults, how they'll vote and shop, looking at ethical choices and the careers they pick that be around service, and in looking at how they give of their time or their money as volunteers or as donors. When you plant a seed with young people, you shift how a future generation looks at the world. And we're trying to shift how this generation looks at their national and the international community they live in and their responsibility towards it.
Greg, it's been a pleasure to speak to you today. As I mentioned up at the front of this, I've long admired you and your work. Continued good luck and in all of your endeavors, especially this book.
Thank you so much, and thank you for the opportunity to share this message. And Joe, I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you on the commentary.ca.
You're very welcome. The book is called The World Needs Your Kid, How to Raise Children Who Care and Contribute. Me to We and Greystone published the book. Me to We.com, FreeTheChildren.com. Do check it out. Craig Kielberger on the line. I'm Joseph Planta.